Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
We're very, very pleased tonight to present Jane Hamilton. And I just want to tell you a little bit about her. I always believe that the shorter the introduction, the better the reading. Jane Hamilton grew up in Oak Park. This area down here, it was her stamping grounds. She lives, I don't know whether you say in or at or on, an apple orchard kept by her husband, which is his profession, in Rochester, Wisconsin, which is near Racine. Jane writes pretty nearly full-time, and I asked her, how are you able to do that? And she said, because I have a good husband. She also said that she doesn't really write full-time because she has two children. She's a graduate of Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, where it gets very cold. And her one teaching stint so far was this past winter up there in Northfield, Minnesota, where for 2 weeks it was 30 below zero. She finds it difficult to teach and to write at the same time because you use the same energy. And she feels that she's very fortunate in the situation that she's in. She says, and I've heard other novelists say the same thing, I really have a very dull life. Sure, if you're going to turn anything out, you have to sit down at a desk, right? And do something. She's published short stories in Harper's. One of these days, I'm sure they'll be collected in a very good book. Her first novel is called The Book of Ruth. And about the Book of Ruth, the New York Times said in its Sunday Book Review, Miss Hamilton gives Ruth a humble dignity and allows her hope. But it's not a heavenly hope. It's a common one, caked with mud and held with gritted teeth. And it's probably the only kind of hope worth reading about. She produced her second very well-known novel called A Map of the World. It was published in 1994. The San Francisco Chronicle wrote about A Map of the World. Jane Hamilton has removed all doubt that she belongs among the major writers of our time. Please welcome Jane Hamilton.
It's wonderful to be here, to be the warm-up band for John Updike, and to be back at the Art Institute, where as a child I went to see the Thorn Room so many times that after a while my mother would bring her book and just point me in the right direction, and I'd go through those rooms. And at some point, somebody who I held in high esteem told me that the Thorn Rooms were the lowest brow thing that was at the Art Institute. And I felt crushed by this, and it's only recently that I have taken on Thorn Room pride. And it's great to be here with that Thorn Room pride. I'm going to read a story tonight that I wrote a couple of years ago. I started with The Colonel, which was stories that a friend of mine had told about her daughter, who was in a brownie troop who was led by a man. And this man apparently had very little scouting experience and didn't understand that there were badges to be worked toward and that there was to be a craft and a snack at every meeting, and these little girls would just run circles around this poor man. And the stories were hilarious, so I knew that I wanted to somehow write about those brownies, but I knew also that it had to go with something else. And a while later, I went to my 15th college reunion, and there were a couple of my friends who had gotten married right out of college and who had nearly teenagers and who realized that the lie we'd fed ourselves when we were 20, that lie that said we could have fabulous careers and healthy, adventurous marriages and above-average children who somehow raised themselves while we were off having our adventures, that had all come apart, and they didn't want to do marriage anymore. And so instead of going to all the seminars about what the liberal arts means to me, we again, as we always had, talked about the man-woman thing. And after the reunion, I went home and woke up one night and realized that, of course, the brownie story was an adultery story. Don't know why I hadn't seen it before that. So, and then just a bit of serendipity that sometimes happens in the middle of the making of a story. I always go to my little library in Rochester. I'm very loyal to it. But one day I was in a neighboring town called Burlington, and I thought, oh, why not? I'll see what they have today, and went into the library. I never check out CDs. I went straight to the CD bin. I never listened to country western. I went straight to Emmylou Harris, picked up a CD, checked it out, listened to the last song on it, which was the most perfect song for the story, and have not been back to the Burlington Library, but have been listening to Emmylou Harris ever since. So this story is called Crossing the Bridge. The year I crossed the bridge, my mother discovered music. Love is a shiny car, Emmylou Harris sang. Love is a steel guitar. Love is a 12-bar blue. Love is your blue suede shoes. It would actually be more accurate to say that my mother rediscovered it, the joy of song. Apparently, in all the years she'd been raising my four sisters and me, she hadn't had the opportunity to turn her ears from the music we made to hear the thin strains of the symphony or the dim, far-off beat of rock and roll that came persistently, like the voice of one more family member from the radio in the front room. It was the five of us, ages 8, 10, 11, 13, and 14, all daughters who kept her from personal fulfillment and happiness. The dial on the radio was turned periodically by the older girls, from AM to FM, back and forth, but my mother had never seemed to notice the variation in sound that came through the nubbly brown grillwork of the speakers. My mother's remedy for nearly every ailment, both respiratory and intestinal, was hot milk. It was my 11th year in 1980, when I woke with a stomachache and went downstairs for the treatment, that I found her swaying to Billie Holiday's voice. I longed to try something I've never had. Never had no kissing. Oh, what I've been missing. It struck me as a silly song for my mother to be listening to in the middle of the night since she had my father. I had seen them kiss each other on occasion. She didn't notice me for the longest time while I stood there hunched, hugging my ribs, bracing myself for the latest strain of influenza. When she finally saw me, she held her heart for just a minute as if it had been outside of her somewhere in that room, and she was making sure before she stepped into the light that it was in fact back inside of her body. She then moved quickly to the stereo and removed the needle from the record. What's the matter, Nell Rankin, she said, coming into the hall. Still full of the dance, I suppose, she took me, before I answered, by the hand into the kitchen, retrieved a saucepan from the hook over the island, and continuing to hold my hand, she went to the refrigerator, hauled out the gallon of milk, splashed roughly 8 ounces into the pan, turned on the burner, and stood stirring. I understood, despite the distraction of my gas pains, that she was not even aware that she was holding on to one of her daughters, or that I had a specific infirmity that had woken me out of a dream. Although I often had the feeling she didn't know I was at her side, that my sisters and I were indistinguishable one from the next, there was something different, something new about the quality of her inattention. My mother was stirring to the beat of the song she'd been listening to, hearing it to herself in the quiet of the kitchen. Got a moon above me, but no one to love me. Oh, lover man, where can you be? My mother called me by both my first and last names, Nell Rankin, as if I had a two-part name like a southern girl. We lived in a small Wisconsin town hundreds of miles west and north of the Mason-Dixon line called Caravan. She did not use our last name with my sisters, who had longer, more elaborate names, the length built into their full first names, Elizabeth, Madeline, Catherine, Samantha. Their names were a testament to the fact that my mother made things difficult for herself. Imagine, for just a minute, the wake-up call every morning for all five girls. I was the only dark-haired one in a family of blonde females and a balding father, the only one who had the southern name, the quiet one between the the talkers on either side of me. I was the only one who was sent to a therapist during the first grade because of what had been termed a natural separation anxiety from the mother. It was true that I did not want to leave my mother, and nothing that Mrs. Jorsted, the therapist, said could assure me of my mother's love or her safekeeping in my absence. I had trailed along at her heels ever since I was old enough to follow her around, not because of her milky skin or the smell about her of stewed fruit and laundry soap or her motherly attention. None of that nonsense, for she didn't really have that sort of skin or smell, and she was attentive only in fits and starts, not a way of being that can be modified by one simple adjective. No, I kept her near me because there were enough of us to make me worry she might lose me, overlook me, forget me. I hardly ever thought about her appearance, her burnt toast odor, her scrappy voice. I knew only a fear that was born of being left, out in the cold, hungry, a shivering, shapeless thing without her. As a small child, I thought she sometimes willfully tried to escape me, that she'd run faster than I could into the kitchen, disappear up the stairs and around the landing so that I could not see her, not see what room would swallow her. I half expected to find her under a bed laughing at my distress, at the tears streaming down my face, laughing at the terrible surprise she had concocted for me. She would see it occur to me, see the knowledge cross my face that this time I had lost her. So I suppose it's fair to say that I had always suspected her, at the very least, of carelessness. When I was 11, before I became a cadet Girl Scout, when I was still a junior Girl Scout, my mother told me that she wanted to film our troop meetings because, she said so artlessly, it might be interesting. My mother did freelance work for various cable channels and an occasional feature for the local public television station monthly news show. It's important to say at the onset that I went into scouting at age 9 when I was old enough to decide for myself that it was something I wanted to do. My father had about him a perpetual sense of good cheer, although he rarely had much to say. He was disorganized, in love with baseball, and according to my mother, a pushover in the world of business. My mother was also quiet, but in a grimly determined way as she went about trying to contain the unrelenting mess of our household, as well as make a career. If she began her day by sorting socks, there might still be a cloud of desperation around her at lunch. What appealed to me so much about the Scouts was their decorum and the beauty of cause and effect. You did a task, you earned a badge, periodically you crossed the bridge in a ceremony at the school gym, a real wooden bridge, white, adorable, with flowers wound around the handrail. You crossed to a new plateau, ever higher, until you had mastered all the skills for living. It had seemed to me, as a child, watching the Memorial Day parade year after year, undoubtedly clutching my mother's legs, that the Girl Scouts would march until they grew up, their uniforms unfolding like new skin, until fully formed women strode in their places, in crisp uniforms, longer sashes, of course, to display more badges, women who would be teachers and nurses and gorgeous lawyers helping to rule the world. It was the idea of the video which took my mother to the library to begin her research on scouting and consequently into the arms, so to speak, of Mr. Tedding. My mother was trying to break her way into hard news instead of filming bake sales and calves being born, and she sensed not only injustice but the possibility for professional advancement when in mid-February we three scouts in our family brought home our Girl Scout cookie order forms. It routinely riled my mother having three daughters in different troops and each of us having to sell cookies and calendars door to door. It was up to her to think of enough people she knew who would be willing to shell out a considerable amount of cash for a small number of cookies, which seemed to get thinner every year and furthermore were not made with butter. I remember her sitting down at the kitchen table slowly, which was the sign that she was thinking or doing math. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. She said all of that even before her bottom made contact with the cane of the chair. It must have dawned on her as she lowered herself inch after inch that someone was making a profit from the Girl Scout cookies and that in all likelihood it was not any one of her daughter's troops or even the National Girl Scout organization. The next day, she no doubt packed us off to school and then pulled on her red rubber boots that had fur around the top and which gave her, in spite of her height and age, a youthful charm. She was tall, almost 6 foot. She had short, straight, silky blonde hair and a face that seemed to have very little contour. I admit that I may be confusing after all these years of knowing her, her impassive expression with her actual features and bone structure. Still, it is true that her blue eyes were laid flat into her face in an oriental fashion and there wasn't much visible lid unless she was sleeping. and her dainty nose seemed to grow up so naturally out of her cheeks. She often had the slightest blush upwards of her jaw, and I suppose it could have been said that she was attractive for a 38-year-old. I imagine her walking over to the library on Main Street, her skin, after the cold six-block walk, glowing, as they say, with health. I see her tossing her ratty green nylon jacket, the one with a smear down the front from my younger sister's head wound the previous winter, on a table, and in her red rubber boots with the fetching loops to latch the flap button and the white fur around the tops, walking over to the reference desk to ask Mr. Tedding for assistance. Mr. Tedding was new in town, the director of the recently remodeled Carnegie Library that had been expanded and made handicapped accessible in keeping with the grandeur of the original design. He was in charge of personnel, policies, and ordering books, and in addition, he occasionally manned the reference desk, which I imagine is where he and my mother first got acquainted. He was much shorter than my mother, as most of us in those days were, and he had soft, flyaway hair that was not a color a person could afterwards remember, much less identify. Still, there was a lot of it, which I think is what gave him a boyish, puckish look. Whereas my mother's elegant face was all a smoothness, Mr. Tedding's every feature seemed designed to quiver, the drop at the end of his pitted nose trembling, his moist lips swelling into a smile, his bulging gray eyes growing ever wider when he was interested or excited. Although he was not handsome, I concede that he may have had that intangible and unnameable something. At age 11, what disgusted me more than anything about him was the fact that he wore loafers with no socks, even in winter. He scuffed around the beautiful new library as if he thought he was at home in his bedroom slippers. I couldn't say then, any more than I can tell now, what makes two people think they want to know each other. If attraction is a result of something as unromantic and understandable as chemicals, elements, atoms, or if, as my mother's friend Dolores' unlikely theory goes, we love those we've known intimately in past lives. Or if strangers connect out of boredom, out of despair at the same old ordinary life, yearning for God only knows what. Or if it's better not to question any of it and then instead label the whole mess mystery. The debate goes on forever while my mother and Mr. Tedding are bent over a reference book at his desk, both hoping it will reveal the Girl Scout secrets and mismanaged accounts. Perhaps in the drab green book they found nothing more than, "I will do my best. To be honest, to be fair, to help where I am needed, to be cheerful, to be friendly and considerate, to show respect for myself and others through my words and actions, to use resources wisely, and to be a sister to every Girl Scout." I suspect that the fireworks, bombs bursting in air, went off in their first meeting, that they were both knocked insensible directly. A dog came running out of nowhere once and grasped me, took my wrist in his whole mouth, and I felt his teeth then and there, and I felt them long after he'd run off. And I wondered later if Mr. Tedding touched my mother's arm on that first day, and if his hand might have felt the same to her, like sharp teeth on a person's flesh, and if she felt the sting and felt it long after the grip was over. As for Mr. Tedding, who can say what appealed to him about my mother? He had a new baby, and perhaps Mrs. Tedding had grown dumpy and uninteresting, or possibly she was juggling child and profession, running home to breastfeed, back to work, leaking, pumping, chasing to the store for nursing pads, back to the office to finish up the paperwork, home to cook dinner, to amuse Junior, and finally falling onto the sofa at 8:30, exhausted. There were many signs that my mother was suffering that winter and spring I was 11, the first of which, as I said, was the music at night and her strange slow dancing in the living room. Even before I had cause to be anxious, I was unnerved by the shape of her in the night downstairs, like a snake she was, waving around as it's being charmed to death. One flight up, my father was somehow sound asleep, tucked between the flowered sheets in his white and blue striped cotton pajamas. "I've heard it said," Billy sang from the second shelf of the home entertainment center, "that the thrill of romance can be like a heavenly breeze. I go to bed with the prayer that you'll make love to me." In addition to the music, my mother began to pay particular attention to the mail, which usually arrived just as I got home from school. There would on occasion be a letter for her, one that affected her as if it wasn't merely a piece of paper, a stamp, a scrawl in black ink. While my sisters and I ate our oatmeal cookies and drank our apple juice, my mother might sit on her high stool at the Butcher Block Island and look at the envelope. She looked at it, that was all. She looked at her name in the strange handwriting, and I suppose she felt as if she had become someone other than her former self, as if her regular name had been made new by the pen of the writer. I can imagine that all she could think of, as my sisters and I argued, was the fresh and undoubtedly lovely idea of herself that was in the mind of the correspondent. Also, in those months, my mother's friend Dolores came over nearly every afternoon to sit at the island and eat the snacks that were meant for children. It was she who banished us from our own kitchen, telling us that she and my mother were going to need a good long time to solve the world's problems. My mother seemed no longer to eat or drink anything, but Dolores brought her own Cokes and forced my mother to adhere to a rigid schedule of making ice cubes. I realized one afternoon that the nature of their discussions had changed, that they didn't talk so much anymore about material goods or about us, both topics that had been formerly of consuming interest to them. "You've got it bad, sister," I heard Dolores saying to my mother one day early in March. "It's a serious and possibly terminal case." I had just come in from the yard where with a shovel I had been whacking at the dirty melting piles of snow we'd made for forts weeks ago. It had been said for several years, I knew, that I was young for my age, that I gravitated and then clung to the younger sisters rather than worshipping the older girls. It was true that I still liked child's play. Dolores was talking while I hung up my snow pants in the mudroom. I hadn't known my mother was sick, and I leaned into the coats to listen. "I know I've got it bad," my mother was saying. "I'm a goner." I slid along the wall and then froze against the stack of umbrellas. That meant my mother was going to die. She had cancer, a terrible variety of cancer. She was going to throw up and talk gibberish and die, leaving us. If she was going to die, and there were already tears running down my cheeks, then I was going to die too. There wasn't anywhere she could go that I wouldn't follow. I didn't want to be in this house, on this earth, without her. "We'll have to get you some saltpeter," Dolores said. "Saltpeter? You know, like they give the guys in wars to take the edge off a soldier's desire. Jesus, what did you learn in school? They used to sprinkle the stuff on the guy's food. Don't ask me how it worked. Blunts the instrument, maybe. Look at you. You're wasting away. You can't sleep. You're mooning around all day and night. You've got the classic symptoms. I've come back from the dead, if that's what you mean. My God, Dolores, I feel as if I'm alive for the first time in decades. I have so much energy. I feel happy now and then. Happy! Even the pain of separation, the pain of teetering on the edge, is a pleasure because it's sensation, because it's not torpor. I wiped my eyes and sat down to take off my brown boots. Let me get this straight, I said to myself. She had come back from the dead. She was happy and also in pain, and at the same time, she was a goner. She had been dead while she'd been having babies and cooking breakfasts and griping while she cleaned, and now she was still doing just as much housework, but she was newly born. She wasn't sleeping or eating. Her flat stomach had become concave. She didn't have the strength to chase her offspring from her own kitchen, but she had energy, so much energy. I would have liked to barge in and shout something or other at the two of them. It wasn't proper or nice or kind for grown women to confuse or worry middle-aged children. I thought as I grabbed a hardball from the bat basket and shoved it repeatedly into my palm that it was actually evil to talk in such a manner when they were supposed to be discussing their daughters and making the world a better place. "Adultery is not for the weak, darling," Dolores was saying. "I know that much. You've got to have presence of mind. You've got to be..." My father stamped in the back door just then. He was wearing a red and black plaid wool jacket with a matching cap, and he was huffing cheerfully, kicking his heels against the brick wall, shedding sawdust all the while. It was as if he liked nothing better than the cold and the damp because it meant he could clap and rub his hands together in an enjoyable way. Dolores had stopped mid-sentence, and at the same moment my mother asked if she and Buddy, Dolores' husbands or the kids, had found the hamster that had gotten loose in the laundry room. "Hi, squirrel," my father said to me. "That's my super trooper getting ready to play ball. Where's your mitt?" "Rick's home," Dolores called so gaily to my mother. He was one of her best customers down at her True Value hardware store, and she always seemed glad to see him. "Howdy, girls," he said, glumping into the kitchen in his work boots. "How you doing?" "Fine, just fine," Dolores declared, apparently answering for both my mother and herself. My mother, then, was not sick, if Dolores' pronouncement was true. "Anything to eat?" my father asked. Extending her arm, and with her long white index finger, my mother pointed at the cranberry muffins that were cooling on the counter. After my father and Dolores briefly discussed the sandpaper he had on order, after she was out the back door to her house across the way, he stood by the sink, drinking a glass of milk in a single audible swallow, and then he went at the muffins, one gone, two gone, half of a third. He had the solid all-American look of a baseball player, square jaw, large brown eyes, dark lashes, receding hair, and a freckled pate, two dimples in his chin. Everyone makes the comment that I look like him, and he always says with satisfaction that at least he got one that's a chip off his old block. "Would you mind saving a few for your daughters?" My mother's voice was stiff with irritation. "Oh, sure, honey." He rarely acknowledged her annoyance, and I never knew if he was oblivious to her various tempers, or if he understood that there was no point in being snared in her drama. He had the enviable ability, perhaps one he had cultivated as a result of living with so many females, of not taking sharp words and killing glances to heart. For some reason, he was more conversational than usual, and he asked her again, "How you doing?" "Dolores told you we're all as fine as we can be." She left, stalking out the front door without her coat on. She returned a half hour later, her teeth chattering and her open, smiling mouth. There was a look she'd get out of the blue during that season, almost as if she wasn't making it herself, but as if it was put there by an invisible hand on her unsuspecting face. We could be eating dinner, the talkers jabbering about every detail of their day, and bang, my mother would look as if someone had punched her. It would happen in an instant and be over, and she'd continue to pass the noodles. But if you caught that expression, you'd see her stricken. Her face would go all hollow, empty, as if she was remembering something awful from her past, or seeing one of us dead in the future. I didn't, of course, know then that desire can come over a person in a flash, like the wind blowing up out of nowhere, crashing down the door, and also that anguish often follows close behind. I couldn't think why she'd need to make such a face when she had all of us. Maybe, I considered, it was because softball season was about to start, which meant my father would be gone every weekend to play in far-off places with his league. Maybe it was because my father's aluminum siding business wasn't doing so well. Or maybe my mother was still worked up over what she called the Girl Scout cookie scandal. Whatever it was, I'd push back my chair and go stand behind my mother and stroke her hair, and sometimes she'd close her eyes and lean into my hands, wrinkle her brow and breathe so slowly as if it was something new she'd just discovered how to do. With her lips parted, she looked as if she was enjoying my being near. That year I was 11, my troop, Troop 162, was led by a Mr. Darrell Peterson. It was 1980, as I said, and the mothers in our town had only recently heard the news about the feminist movement. Everyone was freshly enthusiastic about men cleaning toilets and cooking and leading the Girl Scouts, even with the knowledge that as boys the misters had not been sufficiently trained in the arts, which they were now expected to perform on demand. It was a few years before fathers and mothers would have video cameras hoisted on their shoulders as their standard equipment at the park, school concert, birthday parties, to sanctify so many of those moments of childhood which in truth most of us would prefer to forget. When my mother told Mr. Peterson she was making a feature about the scouting life and asked if she could film our troop, he said in his best Girl Scout leaders, "Let's all live up to our potential voice. That would be both an honor for myself and for the girls." He said, "I would be honored," twice more to my mother, as if the video was going to be a documentary solely about Mr. Darrell Peterson. At the first meeting, we were on our best behavior, but we soon forgot the roving eye that over the months chronicled our little outbursts. We forgot that the camera does not lie, and that in truth we were like badly trained ponies, thrashing in our fraying harnesses, our dude trying to hold all of us at once with his two limp hands. My mother must have been overjoyed that second meeting when we were having a discussion about the cookie sale. I had often, over the noise of my sisters, wanted to explain certain people and facets of my life to my mother, but I always felt that I had to get the sentences in a specific order so that she wouldn't laugh at me or dismiss my opinion. That night, however, Carol Modine described her own self perfectly. If I was a young 11, an 11 in its infancy, Carol's 11 was over the hill. She seemed to me ready to live in her own apartment, to order saucepans and curtains over the telephone with a credit card. She was the kind of girl who was allowed to dress beyond her years, perhaps in keeping with the teenage knowledge she had acquired from the R and X-rated movies that her alleged high school boyfriend showed her in the privacy of his living room. She wore black leather ankle boots and tight black jeans that outlined so clearly each half heart of her sweet bottom. It was a feat to be heard in our troop over the merciless din of girls trading secrets, but by staring at two or three well-chosen scouts, Carol could slow our tongues. One by one, we'd shut up until there was an easy quiet. At my mother's second meeting, Carol made it known that she had an announcement. "I just want to say," she said with one bony hip pointed at me, "that someone in our troop," she glared at Laura Krieger, "was seen taking orders from a teacher." I thought it was against the rules to sell cookies to a teacher. It would, like, be so unfair to do that. "You're right, Carol," Mr. Peterson said. "I mean, a teacher can't buy from everyone, and I just think that's so unfair." Thank you, Mr. Peterson said. I'm sure we all understand the guidelines. I can't believe that any girl would think it was okay when it even says in the rule book and everything. I don't know what kind of girl, what kind of greedy person. Mrs. Trevor is my neighbor, Laura Krieger burst out. She then thrust her more ample hip into the circle, the equivalent of throwing down the gauntlet. Few were brave enough to take on Carol Modine, and we clutched one another's hands, trembling with pleasure and terror. For your information, there's no law against selling cookies to a neighbor, Laura cried. When I was going door to door, Mrs. Trevor said to bring the order form to school because her husband had the checkbook that night. Every time someone does something that's the teeniest, tiniest little bit wrong, Carol acts like she's Miss Perfect, but you aren't. Miss Think You Know. Oh, sure, Carol said. Like a teacher is really going to ask a girl to bring her form to school when they probably everybody wanted that 15-speed bike, the prize for the scout who sold the most cookies. If you listened carefully as the brawl escalated, you might have been able to pick out Mr. Peterson's feeble voice. All right, that's enough now. He even got somewhat violent, calling, knock it off. And there was my mother stepping near the circle to get a close-up. To my surprise, all she ever said about our meetings on our short drive home was, this is going to be good. This is really going to be good. It seemed to me that she had plenty of material to humiliate the Girl Scout organization, or at least get Mr. Peterson removed, even without the cookie scandal. And so I didn't understand why she needed to go to the library every day to gather more data. But a truth that is easily observed, and one of the few things I had figured out already, was this. An acquaintance sees only your purest self. I watched my sisters playing with their new friends every September. So nice, so generous the first and second afternoons. And then their complex selves, their real-life selves, would come through, bingo, and they'd all be fighting with their fingernails. And so one fact I knew, even before I knew much of anything else, was that Mr. Tedding and my mother were on their best behavior at the library, that they were like new friends, kind, and considerate, cheerful, funny and smart, caring, selfless, hiding no little vanities, disgusted by stupidity and waste and gluttony. There was my mother, a warm and loving parent, her arm around me, smiling, asking if I didn't want to check out a few more books. I was such a good reader. And Mr. Tedding showing us his brilliance, pointing out the section, which of course I knew better than he, where the mysteries were kept. He had one girl baby, but he already, because of his library science knowledge and general curiosity, knew what someone my age would like, and furthermore, where it was shelved. It was so remarkable, the way he had the nonfiction call numbers committed to memory. On the other hand, my mother seemed to want her friend Dolores to know every terrible thought she had ever had in her 38 years. She'd tell Dolores about the time she actually wanted to pick us up and throw us straight through the picture window in the living room. She'd talk about my mother and the father in the same disparaging tones she had heretofore reserved for the presidential candidates and the school principal. She hissed at Dolores, "He simply does not speak." She put her hands to her cheeks and said, "Is it too much to ask for talk? Talk, conversation, a little give and take, something more than what's to eat. Did you pay the gas bill? Any clean socks?" When I was 22, I thought it was so wonderful that he was the strong, silent type, full of some kind of, I don't know, wisdom, knowledge that he'd gradually impart to me through the years. "He's quiet, Dolores, because he has nothing to say, not a goddamn thing." "Let's face it," Dolores said, "you were a fruitcake." My mother, with her stack of library books at her side, most of which had to be acquired through interlibrary loan, tried to talk to Dolores about the outmodedness of monogamy, about the absurdity of our patriarchy, the lie of biological determinism. She spoke about cultural oppression, and she made grievous moans when she spoke about how she'd been too late for feminism. "You don't need to have excuses for your feelings," Dolores said. "Stop this claptrap and talk to me about you. Your books are doing nothing but confusing the both of us. You just want to have fun, sweetheart, pure and simple. You've been a slave for 16 years. You want to have fun, and who can blame you? On top of it, you've met someone who laughs at your jokes, hallelujah, a man who listens, a man who doesn't recount the greatest moments of his sporting life in high school, a man who asks questions and who not only notices your footwear, but remembers his little sister's red snow boots. Jesus, God, take him, take him." I don't know what gesture Dolores made then, which made them literally shriek with laughter. 1,000 questions came rushing into my head. My mother never made jokes, so how could anyone consider laughing at anything she said? Who had she met? Why would she want to have fun? She already had plenty of fun, and besides, she hardly had time for the fun she did have. How could being a mother be synonymous with being a poor cotton-picking slave? What did take him mean? Why were they laughing in such a crude and raucous way? It has been said that children do not consider their parents' happiness, that they don't actually care if their parents are fulfilled, but in my case, that was not true. I wanted my mother to be happy, to love us. She was moody and distant, and sometimes I longed to tell her that I was as unhappy as she, that we really had a great deal in common. I think I had the sense that there was more to her question than just lunch, when she'd turn to us at the breakfast table and ask, "Hot or cold?" She'd put her hand to that ravishing throat of hers and ask each one of us, "Hot or cold?" She'd sometimes look as if she wanted to die right then. Hot or cold? The bags of bread were lined up on the counter, along with the peanut butter, the jelly, the bunch of bananas, the bag of duplex cookies. The school menu was clipped to the calendar. Pizza burger, green jello, salad with ranch, pickle spear. Hot or cold? It's no surprise to me now that Carol Modine was the person who told me the essential facts of my particular life. I wondered afterwards if a person grew to be shameless in the way skin or hair grows, or if her type of confidence was the result of some essential fabric wearing thin, diminishing. She could deliver any information at all, no matter how horrifying. We were at our scout meeting, sitting at the lunch tables in the cafeteria at school, working on the May baskets, which we were going to take to the retirement home in town. This activity would give us points toward our eco-action badge, since the baskets were made out of plastic milk jugs, as well as contribute to our World in My Community badge. Carol was sitting next to me, intent upon the business of gluing sequins and rickrack to the plastic. "Your mother and the library guy are doing adultery," she said. She grunted as she pressed hard into the jug with her palm. I wasn't aware at first that she was speaking only to me and not to the group. I was trying to thread the stem of a dried cornflower through the dubious weave of my basket. "I said, your mother and the library guy are doing adultery," she thrust her creation at arm's length. "Everyone knows it. My mother and Mr. Tedding. Carol Modine was talking to me." "So what?" I muttered. I understood the definition of the word, that adultery was a dumb adult education class about something everyone should have already learned. Carol Modine snorted and slowly brought the jug to her chest. She turned to look at me, squinting, as if before her had been placed an unbelievable specimen for her study, a deviant person, a girl who could make such a remark. "So what? That's all you can say? So what?" It was the length of time between the so and the what that alerted me to danger, the crucial absence of sound, which made me understand that I might not know something important, something that Carol obviously knew. I bent over my flowers, arranging them in neat lines in further preparation for the weaving. "You don't even care if your own mother kisses someone who isn't her husband, and I don't mean just kiss." She lowered her voice slightly and leaned toward me. "I mean French kiss." I stopped breathing and stared straight ahead. I was thinking hard how a kiss could be a kiss and French at the same time. I knew what an Eskimo kiss was. I liked my father giving me that sort. The French wore berets and had long loaves of bread and said "oui" instead of "yes." Did a French kiss involve a hat on askew, arms full of baguettes, making that "yes" word, "oui, oui, kiss, kiss, oui, oui"? "Because that's what adultery is, for your information," Carol went on in her percipient way. "You probably didn't know that, but it's when your mother French kisses with someone not in her family. And everyone knows that your mother does it with Mr. Tedding. I mean everyone. And now you know it too." She folded her scrawny arms across her flat chest and sat back, momentarily satisfied with herself. "It's so funny." She said the words "ha, ha, 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 ha," as if that two-letter word in sequence was actually laughter. "It is really hilarious that you're the only fifth grader who doesn't know this stuff, and your mom is the one who's doing it. In case you still don't get it, like, duh. French kissing is with tongues, like they stick their tongues into the other person's mouth and feel all around. Teeth, canker sores, spinach from lunch. It's totally gross." I looked up into the small black eye of my mother's video camera. I opened my mouth to scream. It took me a minute to realize that I wasn't making any noise with my mouth wide open, that I was standing still, mute, trying to find my mother's real eyes as she zoomed in on me. I could not possibly take the story to the end of its many possible conclusions. I refused to think about our house being broken up and my mother leaving town where she had always lived to go away with Mr. Tedding, or my mother taking us to live with Mr. Tedding in his ranch house out on Highway 11, or my father going to a shabby apartment so that Mr. Tedding could become our new literate and verbal father. Instead, I organized my nightmare around the details of my mother loving Mr. Tedding. When I thought about the little scenes, my heart beat so hard I wondered if it might give out, if it might die from my vision of particulars. My mother would acquire new habits from Mr. Tedding. She would come home late one night with a strange smell of freshly printed hardcover books, or she'd make an exotic salad dressing, proud of herself for an urban, sophisticated recipe that required mail-order vinegar and olive oil. She'd put on a record of a singer, a group that we had never heard of before, that didn't seem to belong, buzzing through the head of the mother we thought we'd known. Perhaps, point by point, she would gradually become unrecognizable. I let myself believe that the most shocking change might actually be the smaller details of life. Mr. Tedding teaching my mother to fold her dish towels in equal thirds, to organize the pen drawer, to go, God forbid, without socks. I remember coming home early from school with one of my many fevers at the beginning of June. My mother was sitting by herself at the kitchen table. She was sitting perfectly still. I came quietly up the back stairs and stood at the screen. She reached to pick up a paring knife, and then she slid open the large brown envelope she had in her lap. She looked inside, then turned her head towards the door, shut her eyes, and uttered a small gasp. "Sick," I explained. "This time I really am." She put her head to her mouth and accidentally tipped the envelope so that the contents spilled to the floor. Pages and pages of lined notebook paper covered with her own graceful writing. It took me a long time, years in fact, to realize that the brown envelope contained all of the letters she had written to Mr. Tedding and that he had returned them to her. I recall going to stand behind her chair, wishing she would put her head back so that I'd know it was all right to touch her hair. Instead, she got up, threw the chair aside, and hugged me, rocking me, holding me so hard it didn't feel good at all. She was gulping for air and also hiccuping. I remember being filled with an unreasonable happiness as she nearly squeezed the life out of me. I must have known somehow that my mother was inextricably stuck with us, that what had come back to her in that envelope was all of the feelings she had sent out, feeling that should have remained within the four walls of our house. We were the owners of those feelings. They were rightfully ours. She muffled a sob on my shoulder, let me go, and then left the kitchen. I heard her slam her bedroom door. I went to the sink and smiled out at the yard at the ugly purple irises that looked as if they were panting. She was stuck with my father's unending kindness, his unchangeable habits, and his absence. She was stuck with every day coming one after the next, the grass growing, the bees in the chimney each summer, suppers growing cold. She was stuck with her own best remedy, the bounty of hot milk in a white cup on a winter night. My mother did not make her documentary about the Girl Scouts and their cookie sales. There was, last year, a national news magazine show that did a feature on the very issue that had consumed her the spring of 1980. I happened to be home for vacation, and we sat watching the clips of the Scouts going door to door with their order forms in hand. We watched without, as was our custom, saying a word. When the commercial came on after the segment, I remember thinking that now was as good an opportunity as any to ask my mother about that spring 13 years before, about the season that had given me so much anxiety. Although I was old enough to know better than to place blame, I was sure I could trace my lack of faith in just about everything back to my 11th year. I had always meant to ask her and also let her know why I'd been so extravagantly sullen, so grandly silent as a teenager. I would patiently and kindly explain, without a trace of self-pity, what was at the root of my chronic insomnia. I hadn't planned to speak to her at that moment, but the piece about the Scouts provided the perfect opening for the talk that I'd been preparing for quite some time. I would ask the question, and she would have to answer. I expected her to say that she didn't remember much about those years, that raising the five of us was now a blur. But I fully intended not to let her get away with a failure of memory. I wasn't going to have it. With my coward's heart fluttering in my chest, I first muted the sound on the television, cleared my throat, and then said, "It must have been difficult back then, the three of us in different troops." "What?" she said, looking up from the Sunday paper. Well, it's just that it must have been hard, you know, the three of us in different troops. Dad gone so much of the time." She gazed at the bookshelf across the room at the lineup of our school photos year after year. We were all grown now, and she was left with our studio smiles from the toothless to the pink lipstick phase. "No," she said firmly to the photographs, as if she was speaking to us on the shelf in every one of our stages. I enjoyed it. I loved that era. I was poised to blare my line, "Don't tell me you can't remember." I had been going to say in a controlled and mature way that although she had been able to forget, I had not. "I had the time of my life, actually," she said, removing the papers from her lap, rising, walking away, going into the kitchen to check the roast. I remained in my chair for a moment, staring back at my own fifth grade face. "Oh," was all I could say as she disappeared around the corner. "Oh, well, the time of your life. The time of your life." There were tears burning in my 24-year-old eyes. I got up, went out the front door, and started to run, and like a child, I didn't care where I went as long as it was away from that house. I had been thinking I might tell her the true reason she hadn't been able to find any of her videotapes of our meetings that year she filmed Troop 162. She had spent several days emptying every drawer and cupboard in our house late in the spring. She would never find them, that I knew, even as I helped her search from the attic to the basement. I had discovered the tapes in her office the week before. I had been determined to find them, to prevent them ever from being shown to anyone in the world, our nation, in caravan, or in our family. I had taken them from the cubbyhole in her desk to my room, hacked the cartridges apart with a hammer, shredded the ribbons of film with scissors, and thrown the debris in a trash barrel in Echo Park. They had gone to the landfill in Muskego forever. When it became clear that the tapes were not going to reveal themselves, she shrugged her shoulders and said that her scheme probably wouldn't have amounted to much anyway. Without complaint, she went back to filming the parades, the Kennel Club shows, the grand openings, the annual Brat and Corn Fest. It's possible that she had abandoned the idea before the tapes were missing, after I disgraced her at the year-end Girl Scout banquet. She may have realized that beyond exposing the chaos of one troop and the slave labor of selling cookies to feather a nameless entrepreneur's nest, what she really was doing was exposing me in all of my neurotic splendor, and therefore, of course, herself as well. At the Girl Scout banquet, the girls in Troop 162 and many other troops countywide were going to cross the bridge, ceremonially moving from one age level to the next, in the ritual known to all insiders as bridging. The white bridge that had been stored all year in Mr. Peterson's garage was set up on stage in our elementary school gym, the pink carnations wound in a garland over the railings. I got up on stage all right when it was our turn to pass from junior Girl Scouts to cadets. I was looking forward to handing down my green uniform to my younger sister and getting my own new blue sash and skirt. I even felt pleased with myself when Mr. Peterson was reciting our good deeds and listing the badges we'd worked hard for that year. Carol Modine's older sister, Janet, was on the other side of the bridge giving a flower to each girl as her name was read off after she crossed. I was standing waiting when one of my mother's night songs came to me. It was Emmy Lou Harris's sad, lonesome voice singing to me as if to warn me. "I crossed on the river, there'll be no returning. I crossed all the bridges, I watched them all burning. And now I'm a stranger to a strange land I'm going, where all is forgotten and nothing's forgiven." Afternoons too lately, my mother had been singing in the kitchen alone with a record as she did the dishes. "But I cried a river for him that's deeper and wider than I'll ever swim." Mr. Peterson was getting closer to the end of the alphabet, drawing nearer to my name. Most of my fellow troop members were already on the other side, their brown sashes over their little breasts, those swellings as precious and tender as new potatoes. The girls were grinning at me, their big teeth shining in their little mouths. "Nell Rankin," Mr. Peterson announced. "And by the way, let's give a loud round of applause for Nell's mother, who took the time to make films of our troop meetings." "I'm not going," I whispered to no one in particular. "Nell, you may cross." "You can't make me," I said out loud this time. I thought of that empty, hollow look my mother used to get at the dinner table, what she might have looked like all the time if she gave up her soul to Mr. Tedding. "You can't make me," I called it out this time. There was a murmur in the audience, a few clicks of the grandmother's tongues, and then a hush. "I'm not going," I said, so that now every single person in the gym heard me. But Janet Modine came to me instead, smiling, jeering. She crossed the bridge to my side. "Here," she said, thrusting the carnation right into my chest. "Here's your stupid old flower. You get it no matter what." Thank you.